Addressing up here at the front, this is a homecoming for my two speakers tonight, both of whom have been visiting fellows to Mansfield College at different times. To my right, I have Joe Klein, well-known columnist, political commentator, novelist, the writer of Primary Colours. It became a movie with John Travolta. And we won't say who played the part of the sort of journalist person in it. It's my great pleasure to welcome back Joe Klein. And in the left corner, I'm welcoming back Paul Solman, who also was a visiting fellow here, and it's been wonderful to see them both coming back at the same time, and we've had a very nice reunion. And Paul is an economist. He is a television presenter on matters economic and business, and he does that for PBS NewsHour, and he's been doing it there. He's a sort of stalwart. He's been there doing that since 1985. When he wanders in the streets of Oxford, people stop him and say that they recognise him from the telly. And so it's really great having you back too, Paul. Wonderful. So a rousing applause. There you are. They feel they belong to Mansfield College, and I feel they belong to us. And I'm thrilled to have them here, and I'm very thrilled to welcome their wives, who are both here with them as well. There they are. It's great to see you both. I thought it was going to be rather good fun to get them both here, since they were in the UK, and to get them to talk about the eruptions, the whole set of changes that have taken place, both in your country and in ours, but particularly in your country, because you can be the emissaries from the United States to tell us all and to give us some insights into what has been taking place. And so I'm going to kick off by asking, how is your president, Mr. Klein?
Hey, first of all, before we get to that, to the unpleasantry, I just want to say on behalf of me and maybe even Paul that
you go right ahead.
It is, we were just at the turf, and on the way
at
back.
The turf. You do understand where we're talking about, the public house, not the racing, the race course.
And with the tab picked up by Professor Rasmussen's son, I might add, on behalf of Balliol's BPE program.
Yeah. but we were remarking to each other, how unbelievable it was to be in this place, which is kind of a theme park for elderly people like us. it's our version of Disney World. And so it's wonderful to be back and to see so many familiar faces. And of course, the Baroness. Now, President of the United States. This is a very curious question, because he's been doing it now for a little bit more than 100 days, and I still have absolutely no idea what he believes, nor do most people, nor do many of our allies, nor do members of his own party. When he was elected, I'll tell you how much of a surprise it is. I'm part of this group that meets for lunch every 4 years on election day. That includes many of the hotshots of American journalism and television. And we have a contest where we each throw in $20 and we're made to predict not only who's going to win, but the percentages, who's going to win each state, what the percentages in each state are going to be, and so on and so forth. There were 32 of us, and no one correctly predicted this election. And so we took all the money and gave it to the Committee to Protect Journalists because we figured we're going to need it.
You certainly will.
And maybe I would say that when I was here in this room last, in May of last year, I showed this picture, which was the so if you you may remember, it was the prediction markets, and it was the current prediction as of May, just, I think it was actually this day a year ago, and Trump's chances were 30%, which seemed not terribly high. And the point I made at the time was, if, on the other hand, I said to you, there's a bomb in this room, 30% chance,
you'd be running for the door.
That's right, you'd all be running for the door. But I figured still 30% chance, and then I had a dinner at Balliol, there's a betting book at Balliol, and a guy in the engineering department, Zhong Yu, said, let's make a bet. I think Trump's going to win. I said, no way. And so I bet him a bottle of sherry against a bottle of port. And yesterday I traipsed up to Little Clarendon Street and bought a bottle of sherry and hung it on his door at the Jenkins Building. Because I too, even though I understood the nature of odds, my father used to work at the racetrack, horse racetrack in New York when I was a kid. I'd been there and grown up, and I've cashed bets on long shots. But somehow I did not fully internalize what a 30% chance meant, which is that 3 times out of 10, it's going to happen.
So back to this business of the 100 days. I mean, it is quite hard to track it, but he's on the one hand presented himself to the public as being a protectionist, that he was going to be protecting America's jobs, America to come first. And all of that. He made it very clear that he was not going to be a kind of bomb dropper in other places, that he was not going to get involved in that kind of business. And he made a set of promises, quite a number of which he's retreated from. Have you been documenting his retreats?
Well, everybody's been documenting his retreats, and then it's kind of like a very exotic Latin dance where he retreats and then he moves forward again and then retreats back 2 steps and then comes forward another step. I think that one of the best descriptions of Trump that I've seen was in a column 2 days ago by George Will, who's a conservative columnist, and he said, Trump not only doesn't, it's worse than the fact that he doesn't know what he doesn't know. He doesn't know how to know. And this is, I've lived a life, and Paul has as well, and Helena has as well, where we are immersed in these questions of policy and political practice. We have a very precise fairly precise knowledge of what we don't know,
and we're terrified, I think that's not too strong a term, terrified of getting things wrong.
Yes.
Of making mistakes. I can remember a mistake I made about the Dresdner Bank in the 1970s. I mean, I'm not prepared to say that. It just comes up because the anxiety stays with me. How could I have screwed up the thinking that the Dresdner Bank was in East Germany? So we're so focused on.
But the other part of it is that we both have this unnatural pleasure in knowing how to know and how to learn new things. And the politicians I've been closest to over the years, from Daniel Patrick Moynihan to Bill Clinton to Barack Obama, all had similar joy when it came to learning things and mastering things and making very precise calculations about things. And this guy doesn't give a whit about any of that.
I
just used a euphemism for that, out of respect for the institution.
Well, and everything one knows about him, has, if you've read his works, although they're not written by him, but he somehow dictated or okayed them.
His works, anything like that?
Well, okay, but books, volumes, is that every single move is instrumental. It's not belief, it's not ideology, it's not what I think ought to happen, it's how do I get to what I want, period. And so all of the positions you mentioned, were completely matters of convenience. What would play? What got the crowd roaring?
Yeah, it's a, but and it's a, it's projection is really important with this guy. Whenever he would be accused of something during the campaign, he would immediately accuse Hillary Clinton of the same thing. It's one of the reasons why she was lying Hillary. And now it's carried over into his governance. The House of Representatives passed this utterly ridiculous health care bill that will never be enacted. But they did it. He wanted to have it done. And I'm sure he still doesn't
to
know.
To keep the promise.
Because people, because when it lost the first time, he was accused of being, you know, ineffective.
Yes, so yes. He needed
and
something.
And all, he didn't care what was passed.
Right.
As long as something was passed, you know,
yeah.
He now has had a win.
And how does, yeah, but how does
and that? And sad to say, by the way, much of the American media will play it that way.
Has already.
That he's had a win.
Yeah, no, that's if you look on Google News now, it's, you know, Trump wins.
But I want to ask you, when you say it will never be put into effect, or it will never be effective, what are the defects in it?
I mean, the main thing is moral. I come here to sing the praises of a bicameral legislature. The fact is that the Senate, which was called the cooling plate for American democracy, works in a very different, has a different DNA than the House. The House tends to be more extreme. Bills then go to the Senate where they're sanded down.
After the Roman Senate, the whole idea of checks and balances, we don't have the Greek mistake of, you know, the democracy that Thucydides described and the American founding fathers were terrified of.
Yeah,
and that's why we built it the way we built it.
You chose a Roman rather than a Greek system.
Absolutely. And the Senate is senatus. I mean, it's the same.
Yeah.
But you know, Pat Moynihan always said, and he's since been proven wrong, that major legislation will only pass the Senate with 75 to 80 votes because of the nature of the body. That's changed now because the rules are changing. But Moynihan also said famously, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but not to their own facts. And now we seem to be living in an era where people are entitled to their own facts.
But Joel, I just want to understand, or either of you, I mean,
what's going to happen?
Yeah, what's going to happen?
What's going to happen is this, that any bill involving major expenditures of money, taxing, or spending goes through the Senate Finance Committee before it hits the Senate floor. And what's going to happen there is that two gentlemen, one of them is Chuck Schumer, who is the Democratic minority leader, who is also the minority leader of the Finance Committee, and Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who is the majority leader, who is the chairman of the Finance Committee, they're going to cut a deal.
You should explain that Lamar Alexander is not a Trump Republican.
He's a moderate Republican. The two of them are friends. I know them both. Lamar Alexander has told me I can make, you know, I can really get along with Chuck Schumer. And what's going to come out of the deal, the only thing that I will, I don't like making predictions, but I will predict that the only possible answer to come out of this is going to be keeping the system known as Obamacare with some modifications to make it more stable. I think that this can be easily done, and then the question is whether the House will vote for it. And there's been a rule on the Republican side that that unless a majority of Republicans agree with a piece of legislation, they can't vote for it. And I believe that rule is going to be tossed aside in the course of this. This is all kind of arcane, I imagine. But the bottom line is that if anything passes, it's going to be, I believe, a mild improvement on what we have now. And it'll be a major victory for Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's how it
is. And therefore, and we have, this is a point of serious disagreement between us, I tend to want to have a Donald Trump health care bill passed. because I want his constituents...
But not the one that I'm just...
No. I'm talking about the one that passed now, the one that just passed. I would like to see that passed because somehow the constituency that elected him has got to be made to see that he is so manifestly not governing or thinking or having any impulse that's in their interest, that something needs to wake them up. Joe's point is...
You're a Maoist.
Well, in 1970, I had this discussion with Daniel Ellsberg, and we were talking about the Vietnam War and so forth, and I was making this claim. It's the last time I made this claim, and Daniel Ellsberg said to me, don't go there because you do not realize how fragile democracy can be.
Absolutely.
And so I've been off this line ever since. So it's whatever that is.
And we're going to get you back off of it now. First of all,
the horror of Trump has led him back to infantile Marxism.
Infantile Marxism is something I remember. That's Lenin's term.
It's fair to call the bill that passed the Trump bill because it's more of a, you know, traditional Republican conservative bill, but something like that. My arguments against here are that something like that will never pass, but I would be against it if it did, because it will cause tremendous human suffering.
Pain, yeah.
Human suffering in the pursuit of a theory, and a political theory and I don't even hold with the political theory, and this is the more profound disagreement that Paul and I have. He believes that economics determines an awful lot of behavior and political alliance, and I believe that what we're really talking about here is tribalism.
And to be clear, we can go into this, and I have slides about this if we ever get to them. But when I'm talking about the importance of economics, it's that. Let's see if I can get there quickly. I don't go to give you the pamphlet. The pamphlet was great, but it
looked like one of my husband's operations.
It's actually a sheep's liver. But what you look at is the how slim the margins are. Well, I see where I am. But okay, sorry. Here is this is the slide I want. I was going to do this in consecutive. So you're talking about a polity in America where the least that a Republican's gotten in any, you know, in any reasonable lifetime was Barry Goldwater in 1964, and he gets, what, 38%, and then you have George McGovern getting schlonged by Richard Nixon, if you'll pardon the verb.
It's a Trumpian verb.
It's true. And a Colbertian verb as well, it seems. And he gets 37.5% of the vote. So say 40-40 to start back as early as 1972 when we start. Then the South in America becomes Republican, whereas it had been Democratic before. And we have minorities and groups that come into this country enlarging the population largely from these places like Central America and so forth. And so I would say we're up around, and I'm just making this up, but it's around 45% on either side. So on any issue, 45%, then you've got about 10% to play with. And my point is not that economics determines everything. My point is that economics swings that 10% and the inequality and the deindustrialization that we're experiencing. That's where our argument is.
I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
So I think that what this last...
Here is, by the way, where we are this time.
Well, there's no doubt... But one of the things that became very clear in the American election was that I always think it's patronizing to imagine that people are stupid. I don't think that people are stupid. I think that people made a decision that there were things that mattered more to them, perhaps. And some of them were about a sense in which they were marginalized, talked down to.
Yes.
There was a consensus around the posts, which was rather sneery about the lives that they led and so on. And somehow this
there, that, also that, that's my picture for what you're talking about.
But there were also.
Is that a fair picture? Because I mean, We have the same argument is made here in Britain, that a lot of the people who voted for Brexit were people who were feeling that that's an outsider thing. Now, there was certainly a cohort of that, but a large swathe of the people who really voted for Brexit in this country were Middle England. It was actually much more, and we had someone say this last week, it was about the English feeling tribal.
This guy's Middle American.
Yeah.
Homer Simpson is Middle American. He's not some kind of, you know, out on the tail of the distribution somewhere. He's made fun of, but the point of the picture, and this I showed this picture when I was here last year, is that people like us have this attitude towards people like him, and as a result, there's, you know, it's Peter Griffin from the whatever that is, and you get this. I mean, you get that, and I think this is a huge part of what the colony was doing.
Well, but the other thing is that the Democrats were really complicit in this, and Hillary Clinton especially was complicit in this. And what mostly happened in this election was that a lot of people who came out for Obama simply did not come out to vote for Hillary Clinton. And not because she's a woman, not because she's a feminist, although I'm sure that there were some who were like that. But I would go to her stump speeches, and she would always end it with a recitation of the rights that she was in favor of. You know, I'm in favor of rights for African Americans, and rights for immigrants, and rights for Latinos, and rights for women, and
gays,
and LGBTQ, whatever other initials have since been added, and pay equity, and all these rights and rights and rights and rights. And that's the message that Middle America got from the Democrats, was, you're a bunch of bigots. And she never put it in the most important context of American life, and I think British life over the last 50 years, is that we've gone through a human rights revolution unlike any in the history of the world. You know, we went from segregation in the United States to the point now where 50% of our black population is middle class and higher, where the black women represent the largest percentage demographic group going to college of any demographic group. And the women's revolution, incomplete, but is certainly one of the most victorious. And at this point in the United States, to a certain extent, we have a greater challenge in trying to educate boys than we do in educating girls. And as for the gay revolution, that happened in the blink of an eye. And, you know, untold amounts of unnecessary human suffering have been eliminated over the past 50 years because of these revolutions. And Hillary Clinton would have won this election, I believe, if she had congratulated the white people of America for you know, coming along on this trip. Maybe not in as bald a sense as that, although she didn't really ever have the skill to communicate anything with irony and charm, and which this message would have required. But the fact is that Democrats, you know, the message from Democrats to the majority of people in the country was, you're a bunch of bigots.
Well, that's and that is one way of looking at it, and I don't think it's incorrect. The question is really what weights you assign to the various variables that were at play here. And when I go out and talk to people, their antipathy towards Hillary Clinton and towards Democrats in general has been, wait a second, you've been promising us a better life, and it hasn't happened. Now, we went with Obama. I've got here, this is Macomb County, and just south of Detroit, it's the eight miles.
It's actually north.
North, so it's 8 miles, and then it's immediately north of Detroit. And this is a famous county because this is where the Reagan Democrats were first
located.
And here we have 1980, and you can see that Ronald Reagan beats Jimmy Carter there handily in what was thought to be a Democratic county stronghold. And then you have George Bush winning, and then you have 96, we have Bill Clinton winning, 152-120, almost exactly the same numbers as Reagan beating Carter. And then 2004, you have George Bush winning again. Now, and then you have in 2008, Barack Obama. And he's got the highest number you've ever seen in Macomb County. And then you've got him still winning in 2012, and now look at 2016 at the bottom. And there we have Trump getting a number that even beats Obama's number in 2008, although, remember, the population is somewhat larger than it had been, you know, back then, but not much. So now you can interpret this two ways. One is that these people are simply responding to what Joe's saying, you know, and responding to this change. But what I interpret these numbers to mean, and it's just interpretation, don't pretend to know, is that people said, ah, we have enough people in a place like this said, we've been doing poorly for years. I have another graph I can show you to make my whole economic case, and maybe I will show it, but 90% of Americans are doing no better than they were inflation adjusted since 1980. They're doing slightly worse. So somebody comes along and says, I'm going to change. There will be change for Barack Obama. But I think what they hear, first and foremost, although not only, what they hear is, ah, things will be better for me. And then they have 8 years and things didn't get
better. See, I really...
I just finished. And then they get their 8 years and they go, ah, this guy says, make America great. And it plays in, of course, remember, I'm only talking about 10% of the population, because the other ones are committed already, right? And sure, there are other things going on among that 10%, political correctness and all the rest. But if I have to weight the variables, I'd say this variable is of considerable importance and cost her the election.
Is the economy stupid?
Yeah. I think that's... Is there anybody in this room who seriously believes that Americans aren't living better now than they did in 1980?
But it's all relative.
Paul, you had your moment, let me have mine.
Okay. I'm in the chair. I'm going to hold your part. Yeah, okay. What do you think?
Well, I think that there has been an awful lot of propaganda directed at this particular group, especially by a fairly new and powerful phenomenon under the sun, which is the strength of right-wing media, that is constantly telling people that things are terrible. I mean, Donald Trump got up at the Republican convention and said that our cities are ravaged by crime when the crime rates have dropped precipitously since 1980. Nobody had cell phones in 1980. You know, there wasn't Walmart to the extent that there is in 1980.
There wasn't the Twitter sphere.
Yeah, there was, the thing is that nobody started. And, you know, what has changed, and this is more of a cultural than an economic phenomenon, was that in 1980 you could support a family with one salary. You know, a steel worker was making 18 bucks an hour in 1980, which was pretty damn good money with all kinds of side fringe benefits. But what has changed is a cultural change, so that for an awful lot of men, they have now had to come to deal with the fact that their wives have as much economic value or perhaps even more value than they have. And all of this is, I believe, you know, the economic part, economics are certainly part of it, but the cultural change and the threat that people who have assumed power, white men, no longer are going to have that power. By the way, all the things that they're afraid of, you know, I go out and talk to people, they're afraid, you know, their grandson has become gay, their granddaughter is marrying someone from South Asia, you know, the President of the United States didn't have the good sense to be black or white, and his middle name was Hussein. These are all things that I love about the country and that are our greatest strengths. But these are cultural issues at bottom that, you know, my mentor, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and Nat Glaser, in Beyond the Melting Pot, you know, argued that ethnicity was a far stronger factor in American lives than economic class.
Yeah, look.
And now we're having not ethnicity is declining because of intermarriage, as it will continue to do, but we're retribalizing via, you know, television networks. I mean,
yeah, but look, I don't disagree that we agree with regard to tribalizing. I'm saying that the tribes are already in those 45% for the most part. I put here a slide which shows exactly the guys you're talking about. It's men without a high school education, and they, without any question, at least from my interviewing of them, feel dissed by people like us, feel dissed by The Simpsons or Family Guy, feel dissed by the way we treat them, and that's a function of. To some, again, we're talking about weights here. We're not talking about one thing is true and the other isn't. They feel that their relative standing, and that's all that matters
but
in
it's
life. Their relative economic standing has gone down precipitously versus.
I think it's
the
their relative cultural standing that's gone down.
Well, no. But I think that follows from the economics. That's exactly what I'm saying.
But it's probably a combination of the two. I just want to deal with the fact of deindustrialization, because I think there's a common factor in Western developed societies, you know, mm-hmm. that, and it's true certainly here, and it's certainly true in the United States and the creation of Rust Belts and the like, which is that in your country and in ours, there was that sort of great, you know, revolution, the end of real industrialization. The story about how we were moving to a knowledge economy, mm-hmm. and that therefore people needed to have more education because people were going to have different kinds of skills and so forth. The closing down, and we had the kind of eruptions in our society here over the ending of mining. Mm-hmm. We haven't quite got to the same stage quite totally yet the way that we have had. But the ending of steelworks have disappeared, shipbuilding, all those big, very male industries are gone. And we didn't find a way through, and nobody bothered to spend the time really in thinking about how you addressed what that did, if you like, to the psyche of people.
Yes.
And to some extent, you see, I would argue that it suited capital, it suited big business, but suddenly a fabulous thing started happening around the same sort of time, which was that women started demanding independence. And the growth of the women's movement, which at first was resisted by the establishment, suddenly was embraced by the establishment. It was co-opted by the establishment and big business, because it meant that if more women worked, were encouraged to be independent, to have their own bit of money and so on, which is very important for women, it also allowed for a shift away, and women, of course, tended not to be unionized. And women were, if you want to talk about the gig economy, women have always been the gig economy, mm-hmm. right? Doing piecework and so on. And the fact about it was that it allowed for a whole churn around mm-hmm. around who is the worker. And so when you speak, Joe, about the fact that in many of those families, men saw the cultural change of their wives becoming, having more economic value. They did have more economic value, but what was interesting was, in real terms, it was a much lesser value, and that's why we've seen the impact on family incomes and so on.
But there are the two incomes together, and sometimes they would be working more than one job. I think that the price of most common services has plummeted over the last 30, 40 years. To me, the image that's in that stays in my mind, I was in Oil City, Pennsylvania, back in the 1970s when I was working for Rolling Stone, and there were a series of teenage suicides. And I went to one family, and there was the husband, who was a coal miner, doing the vacuuming while his wife was out at work. And he looked at me, you know, with this, oh my God, you know, I'm so embarrassed. Kind of, I'm doing the housework. My wife is out, you know, earning the money. When he was also earning money, but not as much as he had in the past. I think that there's a much greater problem, which is, you know, automation and the fact that there aren't going to be as many jobs. And even if Trump manages to bring, and I suspect that, you know, there had already been a trend of manufacturing jobs coming back to the United States, they're going to require advanced degrees, you know, to perform them. You're going to have to go to a community college for a couple of years to get the technical training that you're going to need to perform them. You know, and so the question becomes, how do you keep a society coherent and satisfied when the traditional ways we have had of conferring respect no longer maintain?
And that, I think, I'm very interested in your point about women flooding the labor market and maybe driving down wages. Driving down wages, that's a very interesting point that I hadn't really ever thought of. But the point that Joe makes now, I think, is absolutely the critical question going forward. I was here in Oxford, I was interviewing for my PBS show two researchers who did a 2013 paper, this is just 2 days ago, which they are now updating, on how many jobs, this is in the United States, would be affected by automation. And the number they have is 47% are vulnerable. They don't know over what time frame. 47%. Okay. These are the kinds of jobs we're talking about. Now, last night on the NewsHour, I had a piece that I just produced from Janesville, Wisconsin, where a General Motors plant shut down, and all the thousands of people were out of work. And they have an excellent technical college, Black Hawk Technical College in Janesville, Wisconsin, not far from Madison, Wisconsin, where the university is. And so all these people are told to go to Black Hawk, and lots do from these plants. Two-thirds drop out. This is a two-year degree, as Joe said. This is an associate's degree, a junior, what we used to call a junior college degree in America, now a community college degree. Two-thirds drop out. But the most stunning fact, and the punchline of this piece last night, was that the people who went and got the two-year degrees did worse economically in the aftermath than the people who didn't. Presumably because, right, you're looking like, how could that be? And presumably, but just speculation, there were only a certain number of jobs that you could even get in the area. And the people who didn't go to college got them.
But
I'm just telling you what the woman who did all the work on this, the Washington Post reporter who did all the work on it, did. And that you were now further back in line because you hadn't worked for a few years, and so you had to start at a job that was so much lower. So the real danger here, we don't know how it'll turn out, but the real danger is that the retraining doesn't actually turn out, and that's what we all think, oh, retraining, I mean, Democrats, Republicans, left, right, and so forth. Retraining is the answer, and there is reason to
Democrats
wonder whether
have, Democrats could, over the last 30 years or so, have not believed in vocational education.
Let me finish. Retraining in general.
I can see that being the result in a limited place in a small community where you have one factory that closes. But let me give you the counterexample of the state of Arizona, where vocational education is practically a religion. And your odds, if you go for that two-year degree, or if you take vocational track in high school, your odds of finishing a four-year program are greater than if you don't do vocational education in high school. Because a lot of kids who want to become doctors are training to become physician's assistants, and so that they don't have to build up the huge amount of loans that they have. I think we've gotten a little bit off the track here. And I want to get back onto the most important thing about this election. And it was something that I always thought was going to come, but I didn't recognize it when it arrived. And that is that there was always going to be a white reaction to the increasing multi-ethnicity of the country, and to the fact that at a certain point, you know, white people were going to have to look at the possibility that they, especially older ones, were going to have to look at the possibility that they weren't going to be, the probability that they weren't going to be a majority. That's where an awful lot of this anti-immigration rage comes from, here as well, I would imagine. And I think it's, you know, I plead guilty to being both an optimist and a romantic, but I think that this is a transitory phenomenon. It was brought about by Hillary Clinton and the Democrats' ineptitude in this particular election, and also by the fact that Donald Trump communicated in a way with folks that no other politician ever had. And let me just, one anecdote. Very early in this campaign, Donald Trump insulted Senator John McCain, who was an American war hero. He was captured in North Vietnam, did many years in prison, never broke down when they tortured him, and so on. And he said, and Trump said, you know, he doesn't impress me. The ones who didn't get caught are the ones I like. And every one of us thought,
that's it.
Yeah, that's it. It's over for Trump. But his ratings went up as a result, because, not because people agreed with him, but because they thought, well, I don't know whether I agree with this guy or not, but he's someone who speaks his mind. He's someone who tells the truth. And after 40 years of market-tested language, you know, imposed by, you know, political consultants and pollsters and so on, people responded to someone who just sounded like he was
real,
speaking his mind.
And that would go for the grabbing genitals as well. I mean,
oh, I think that helped him.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. I think it actually gave him sex appeal. Not that people would. No. I don't mean sex appeal in the sense that people were going, oh my God, I'd like to go out with that guy. But that he titillated people in a way that I think excited them, got them less bored, got them interested, and wow, I know it's a horrible thought, but I
you know, the results that you were showing before Bill Clinton and Macomb County, I think were the results of blue-collar males looking at this guy and saying, wow, he's shagging lounge singers, he's eating fries at McDonald's, and he actually seems smart and cares about people like us. He's living the dream.
And they also had the other bit of sustenance, which was the liberal elite, as they're described, also despised him in the same way that they felt despised. Because everybody felt, my God, he's such a vulgarian, he's crass, he's terrible, and therefore they felt that he was getting the same outsider treatment, and he is an outsider.
Right.
And
that's what the fuck you's about. I mean, I think it's you. Oh, you don't like him? Ha ha! That means you don't like us. We're going to tell you. Look, these are all factors. My only argument has been that I think for the swing, and there isn't much margin here, that for the swing, the unemployment drives the status, and the status is
I want to take it to foreign policy, because what frightens all of us...
Put that up, by the way, just so that you see the numbers with regard to whites versus other groups in terms of the voting.
I mean, what's frightening to the rest of the world, looking in, is that he seems to be absolutely sort of trigger-happy. I mean, that you just can't rely on where you'll go next. And there is anxiety around his outpourings about Korea, the extent, what is the real stuff about Russia? I mean, you know, what is his relationship there? I mean, people are still trying to fathom what does this man mean for the world? I mean, he can do to you guys whatever, you know, but there's a worry about what
he's trying to defund public television. So.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that he's attacking journalists, so you should all be worried. But what about for the rest of the world? I mean, he obviously had never had to think about foreign policy in his life before.
Although his instincts were great. I mean, I remember being in South Carolina after Bush started, after Trump started talking about how stupid George W. Bush was to get us into that stupid war in Iraq. And I remember sitting in a bar with a couple of businessmen, Republicans, who said, in effect, wow, that's a relief. I've been thinking that all these years and I haven't been able to say it because of my tribal affiliation with the Republican Party. And so it's difficult to know what he actually believes. There is one great...
Do you think he actually believes?
What you mean, anything?
No, I said before...
Wait, you said it's difficult to know what he believes.
What I said before is that he doesn't know how to know, and if you don't know how to know, you don't know how to believe.
Right, clarifying.
The one really wonderful indicator here is that he's hired a couple of people who I believe are brilliant and honorable, and they, you know, people I know. One of them is his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, and the other is the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis. And
how did he stumble upon them amongst the other crowd?
Because Mattis is, I don't know about McMaster, but Mattis was known as Mad Dog, a completely unfair characterization. He's more of a warrior monk, that's what he's really like. I've interviewed
probably
him.
Probably the best-read American general.
Yeah, he's just a scholar. I mean, that's what he's like. And
H.R. McMaster also
was but he's a no-bullshit talker. Who talks about, you know, who got into trouble. That's where he got the term Mad Dog. From what was the famous line about, you're going to take them out, I like to shoot them. It was some, you know, very macho kind of thing. Trump happens to meet him as opposed to meeting somebody else. Yes, and he goes, oh, this is my kind of guy. Because he's not thinking about anything.
The American military is what stands between you and your worst fears. And, you know, and I've spent a disproportionate amount of my last 15 years with the military, embedding with them, you know, talking to them, writing about them, and this is not a warmongering group. In fact, the fact that we have an all-volunteer service has made them the exact opposite. The ethos of any given general is, I've spent all this time training these people. I don't want to lose them in a war. But the counterargument to that is, I don't know how far the technology has gotten on things like cyber warfare and nuclear warfare. I'm a little bit, I know that our cyber capabilities are substantial, and then probably, although you can't say definitely, the reason why the North Korean missiles are blowing up as soon as they leave the pad. The thing that we really don't know anything about is the advances in the nuclear arsenal. And we may have miniaturized nuclear weapons to the point where if Donald Trump wants to take out Raqqa, there are, you know, nuclear mortars, there are nuclear, you know, shoulder-held hand grenades, projected hand grenades. And he's going to be tempted to use that stuff because he doesn't know, and he doesn't know history. It's very tempting to say, I've vaporized Raqqa. But I think that if he were to do that, H.R. McMaster would quit. There would be a major crisis.
Okay. I want to deal with the thing that has been very big for us here, is to look at a number of things. One of them is about the whole business of his relationships with Russia. And while I don't imagine he was in five and a beige trysts in some Moscow hotel, unless he's completely barking mad,
Don't discount that possibility. No, seriously, do not discount that. This is a guy who's done whatever he wanted from the teenager
on. But let's just deal with the business of his business interests and the fact that he may have all kinds of financial shenanigans that he was dealing with in his Russia. Do you think there's truth in that?
Yes. I think that in retrospect, October 7th was the most interesting and important day of the presidential election. Two major stories broke on that day. At around 11:30 in the morning, the Access Hollywood story about him groping people and behaving as a barbarian and a assaulter of women broke. 3 hours later, the story broke that the American intelligence community had come to the conclusion that Russia was acting in his benefit. So what happened during the next 2 weeks? During the next 2 weeks, it was wall-to-wall women coming out saying, he groped me, he did this to me, he did that to me. Several of them, I think, were really, pretty suspicious, had pretty suspicious stories, and I wouldn't be surprised if he paid women to come out and say that so that the media was diverted from the Russia story onto this other story, which ultimately worked to his benefit. I do believe that the key to all of this are his tax returns. I do believe that it is entirely possible that he's in hock to the Russians and that may have been washing money for them. I don't know whether we're going to be able to find this one, but I think it's really serious.
We do know, that he's laundered money in the sense that many, many Russians have places at Trump Tower, and that's how they brought their money to America. So it's.
And we do know that three floors in Trump Towers are rented out to Chinese, to the Chinese government, actually. As I'm going to move on to that in a minute, which is about the whole business, that in the Constitution somewhere, it does actually say that the president is not supposed to receive emoluments or anything from any foreign governments or people that, they seem to be seeking favor or whatever with his presidency. Why has he been able to do that with impunity? Is there?
Because nobody cares.
Nobody cares.
For that stuff to be to cut through, it would have to have some impact on his supporters, who are no more than 40% of the population, but are given an enormous amount of excess weight by the media now because they won.
By the Electoral College because of how the country is arrayed.
But I do believe that as these things happen, the place to look is the Congress, and it's to people like Paul Ryan, who, what happened to Nixon was that Watergate started, as Democratic fake news. Everybody thought it was ridiculous.
He won. Remember, Richard Nixon won when the story had already broken, and he won.
Yeah.
He won in 1972.
But the details of the story hadn't.
The story was already out there, but it was
a Russian story. But what happened when Nixon went down, it was because there was an accumulation of facts, and that all of a sudden, the moderates in his own party abandoned him. The Saturday Night Massacre.
Yes.
I think you and I were together the night of the Saturday.
Okay, let's take this story through. You have the Russians having some goods on him about his business deals there, which are not in the public domain in America, and which could be problematic for a president. And therefore, the suggestion is that they actually enabled him to secure the presidency because they were involved in the leaking of information against the Democratic Party and all that kind of business, and that they might have had a hand in it. And you're talking about cyber expertise being in the hands of the United States, maybe preventing missiles from Korea being successfully launched. But one of the other things that suggested is that cyber expertise in the hands of the Russians now, certainly in terms of hacking and all that kind of thing, is very real, but also but they may even have been able to possibly hack into the machinery that dealt with the election. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there's
no evidence of that, by the way.
No, I
it's
don't,
not but, inconceivable.
But it's certainly appearing in American newspapers.
And the kind of hacking that they did do is pretty crude stuff. I mean, it's the kind of thing that, you know, a 17-year-old in his pajamas could do in a basement.
Certainly the stuff.
It's not on the level of the Stuxnet virus, which we inflicted on the Iranians.
But I mean, is there any truth in the idea that he actually is soft on the Russians and will continue to be soft on the Russians because they've got by the short and curly?
I think that this guy admires strength, and dictators appear to be strong. You know,
and he's been friends with these guys. I mean, yes. This is a guy who works entirely on the basis of personal relationships. That also means that he can turn on people in a heartbeat, and he has turned on people in a heartbeat. But it's the people he knows and who have been loyal to him. Those are the people who he's dealt with and kept around him his entire life. And so, sure, it's not even so much that they have something on him. They're the people who bailed him out when he was in trouble. They're the people who bought the apartments at Trump Tower when he was so much in debt that he said to some guy, somebody I knew was with him, when he said to a guy on the street corner, there was a bum there, and he said, you know, that guy's richer than I am. You know, the guy outside the park, the Trump Plaza, because he doesn't owe $800 million.
But, you know, I think that, again, the real crisis that we face here is that he is a reflection of the American people at this point. We are a people who have forgotten how to know things. And we have, I mean, in my book, Primary Colors, I created a character named Orlando Ozio, the governor of New York. Machiavelli once said that Ozio is the greatest enemy of a republic. Ozio is Italian for indolence. And what Machiavelli was worried about was, how do you keep a country or republic together when it's not at war? How do you keep the discipline that you need? And in a democracy, you need a fair amount of discipline and a great amount of citizenship. You can't do democracy without citizens. And I'm 70 years old, and during the course of my lifetime, we've had the greatest experiment in Ozio in human history in the United States. And so the reason why this guy won is because people have forgotten how to be citizens, and they have lost track of the differences between fantasy and reality. They believe reality TV is real, and he's a creature of reality TV. I mean, the people he would say you're fired to, he's hired several of them in his administration. We have lost, and I think it's a consequence of the fact that so few of us serve our country now or participate in the government. I think we've lost the habit of citizenship, and I think that's the greatest danger that we face, and that's the greatest lesson from this election. This is why this man was elected.
Now, I don't know that it's the greatest danger that we face, but I certainly agree that this is a huge problem in America and probably in lots of the industrialized world. Yeah, as I say, here and elsewhere, it's a big problem. And I think what it does is it leads to a certain just simple boredom, because you're sitting there and you're watching The Apprentice, and then what's going to keep you watching? You know, he's got to be tougher. You think about any of these reality shows and how they up the ante and again, and now it's somebody who might die or whatever the next level is.
But you've got a level of engagement. I mean, one thing has happened to your politics, and to some extent it's happened to you too as a result of Brexit, is that suddenly we've got an incredible alert populace.
Yes,
I can't say it's everybody, but suddenly people are really arcing.
That's a positive. That's a positive consequence.
But maybe a transitory one.
Yeah, and we don't know how long it'll last. But I mean, we've seen that in the past. But yes, absolutely. People are now scared to death. I mean, you understand. I mean, you all felt when I was here when Brexit passed, and the next day here at Mansfield, at any rate, it was funereal. It was just funereal. People were down. How are you doing? Not so good, you know. In America, we were panic-stricken. I mean, people like us were literally, I probably talked to 15 people, Jan can correct me, my wife was here, but she was one of them, who would go to sleep at night, wake up the next morning and think, well, that must have been a dream. It can't possibly be. And to this day, that happens to me sometimes if I'll see President Trump and I'll have forgotten. And I'll go, oh my God, it's actually Donald Trump is the president of the United States. It's a man we've mocked from the 80s. I mean, literally, to haven't taken even
any slightly. Given day, he will make you, he'll make you crazy on any given day when he says that Andrew Jackson could have prevented the Civil War. I mean, and the Civil War started 16 years after Andrew Jackson.
Well, and that's a minor peccadillo. That's a minor peccadillo.
Okay, guys, there are people out there that want to ask you.
Oh, yeah, yes.
So please, can I open it up to the floor? And I see hands already coming out. Oh, great.